This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on an innovative strategy to reduce the risk of falls in post-acute and long-term care. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's recent trauma due to a fall in her office brought to light an issue that few really think about with any regularity, that even an independent, cognitively intact, and functional elder, Judge Ginsburg is 85, is at risk for falls. To those of us caring for patients and residents in the post-acute and long-term care setting, however, despite our best intentions, active programs, care plans based on understood risk factors described over 20 years ago by Dr. Mary Tinetti, falls remain commonplace, often with daily phone call reports and understandably upset families who don't understand how someone could have fallen to begin with. According to the 2007 review article, Falls in Community-Dwelling Older Adults, a review for primary care providers, 35 to 45% of elders over age 65 and 50% of elders over age 80 had a fall over the course of a year. Earlier data showed that 5% of falls resulted in a fracture, but even without a noted trauma, falls often led to inactivity, decreased strength and agility, loss of independence, fear of falling, recurrent falls, and the need to transition to long-term care. The Centers for Disease Control, CDC, note that the financial toll for older adult falls may reach $67 billion by the year 2020. A 2003 CDC study of falls in nursing home residents was truly alarming. It showed that those residents 65 years and older accounted for 20% of deaths from falls. There were 100 to 200 falls per 100 beds in facilities per year, that the rate of falls in long-term care were twice that of the community, with up to 2.6 falls per resident per year, and that over one-third of fall injuries occurred in residents who could not walk. What is the missing ingredient in adequately reducing the risk for falls in the nursing facility? The toll on residents, family, staff, and providers only increases as another notch is added to the falls cane of care. What more can we do? What additional approaches can we take? Well, Dr. David Smith suggests that perhaps innovation in fall risk reduction is really based in the fundamentals of communication, both within a multi and interdisciplinary level of care. His August 2018 paper entitled Documented, Systematic, and Individualized Communication with the Attending Physician for Fall Risk Reduction, Injury Mitigation Care Planning was spotlighted in the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, JAMDA, Pragmatic Innovations in Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine section. And to further discuss the issue of falls and his innovative project, Dr. Smith is with us now. Dr. Smith is a geriatrician who completed an interdisciplinary fellowship at the Dakota Plains Geriatric Education Center. He considers himself a freelance academician. He runs his own consultative practice called Geriatric Consultants of Central Texas, and he supports long-term care, hospitals, communities, and adult protective services. He also conducts medical legal consultation. Dr. Smith, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Hey, thanks for the invite.
Dr. Smith, in the introduction of your paper, you discussed that the common elements of fall risk were generally recognized by the post-acute and long-term care teams using evidence-based approaches to care. But clearly, you thought that this wasn't enough, and you designed a system of communication with an attending practitioner to lessen the risk for falls. Lead us through your thinking and the generation of this communication strategy, the attending letter. Tell us first about the implementation phase, including risk assessment and the choosing of what I thought was fascinating, the falls champion. And why is this considered a pragmatic intervention?
Let me say that this all comes out of quality assurance, and without breaking confidentiality, the facility where this was born had some pretty bad Casper data on falls and falls with injury, and it was resistant to multiple attempts to move the needle. Eventually, we tried this communication tool and had pretty significant success in reducing our numbers and getting our Casper report in line. The choice of a falls champion, well, we knew we needed someone to look at existing data that we had on every resident to determine those who were our high risk for falls and those that were at risk for injury with falls because of osteoporosis or anticoagulation. A little side note, we chose Ahmed-Aid to be the falls champion because she was just a natural-born enthusiast, and she looked like she needed a job that would set her on fire to go on with her career, and she has gone on to become an RN. Why did we call it a pragmatic innovation? Actually, that's not my term, but JAMDA editors Sloan and Zimmerman came up with this concept with the idea that there should be an opportunity for submissions that are not of the rigors of a randomized control trial, but that do have practical utility in long-term care. And so I was at the AMDA session where this was discussed as a concept, and as you know, I'm an associate editor, so I floated a couple of ideas, one of which was this communication tool, and they asked me to put the submission together, and we did.
So without getting too granular, you talk a lot about looking at medications, but this isn't just medication-based. This has other elements as well as a communication tool, doesn't it?
It does. I tried to hit all of the major issues. Really, fall risk interventions need to be very nuanced. And there's no way that we can cover in a communication tool all of the possible matriculations of this for individual residents. But there are many of these issues like mobility, vitamin D, vision and hearing, et cetera, that are common to most of the folks that are at risk of falls. And that if we had a systematic approach to getting these particular problems dealt with, that we might have a good effect.
So it seemed that it really wasn't so much an extrinsic factor creating falls, but you were trying to also account for those things that might be more intrinsic as well.
Yes, indeed. Additionally, we have a situation in rural America that I suspect is also true in many urban facilities where the attending physician is off-site and doesn't have the opportunity to really be the captain of the ship and lead the care plan team to give guidance and to make opinions on which the rest of the care plan will be built by the nursing staff. And I felt that the communication tool was a route to getting them involved and frankly to put them on the spot for decisions about each one of these areas of fall risk.
So it literally was a letter that was standardized with a number of these fall risk factors that actually was sent to the attending physician in charge of folks transitioning or in nursing facilities.
It was, and we had a return date that if we didn't get an answer, then we would send it as a second notice. Mm-hmm. And if there had ever been a third notice required, it would have come with a telephone call from me, but we never had to do that.
Wow. So This segues nicely. Tell us about your outcomes after 2 years of implementation. Looking at the plans of care and the objective reporting of the CAHPS report that you talk about, you did discuss that the focus was on rural nursing. We just mentioned that. But it really sounds like it could be applied to other locales as well. And in addition, given your medical legal background, can you tell us also about how this functions as a malpractice risk reduction activity?
The comment that I made in the article about the rural nature of our facility was a sort of a Greek apology that it may have better results in our environment than in urban environments where the other doctors are not immediately familiar with the medical director, don't depend on the medical director for call schedules, this and that, things that because we are better known to each other, I may enjoy some compliance that may not be forthcoming in urban centers is all that I was saying there. Mm-hmm. The about the medical malpractice, again, I tried to make this as a way to put the attending physician on the spot to make decisions about a variety of things. For instance, the drugs, I would write up what medications might confer risk of either injury with a fall or a risk of falling, and explain the mechanism for that, and then ask the doc to opine as to whether the medication was really necessary, whether the risk-benefit ratio favored continued use of the drug. We had many times when, with a little tweaking, the physician would discontinue something, but many, many more times when the physician simply said, yes, this is necessary. Wow. And that would be true in all of these other categories of fall risk as well. We're getting the doc to make and document an opinion to support the care that's being rendered. In my experience, both as a medical director and doing med mal work, it's unusual for either surveyors or the plaintiff's bar to question physician judgment, but that what they routinely question is the absence of any documentation that you thought about this risk factor or that risk factor or another. And so simply by getting the decision-making process documented for the record for various clinical decisions, there is a barrier to criticism by either surveyors or plaintiff's attorneys.
Fascinating. You know what this is really? It's a request to become invested in the care of your patients. I guess that's what I see this in. For those of us who do this regularly, who are invested, this seems like a way of saying, hey, pay attention to this aspect of your patient currently in this situation.
Well, thank you. That is exactly right. And I think I was bold enough to suggest that this type of a communication tool might be utilized for practically any clinical area in long-term care where we need to improve the visibility of the physician as the leader of the treatment team.
After 2 years of implementation, can you give us an idea of perhaps an improvement in objective data like the CAHPS report?
Well, yeah, but let me preface it by saying that I cite in the article a number of multi-interventional projects to reduce falls in other facilities, and the best of these seems to lop off about 20% of the falls. Hmm. So that kind of gives you a target to shoot at. That's probably as good as it's going to get. As I said, we had horrendous numbers on our CAHPS report for falls with injury. And after the obligatory wash through period that the CAHPS report requires, we got our numbers down in the 30th percentile compared to the state and the nation. which got us out of quality assurance trouble. And that has pretty much persisted.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Among all charitable organizations, our foundation uniquely advances the interests of PALTC professionals by working to develop and expand our workforce and by focusing on innovation and quality improvement. Your contributions to the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine make a big difference. Please make a contribution today through our website or by calling the AMDA office.
We're talking with Dr. David Smith about falls in post-acute and long-term care. Dr. Smith, I found it interesting that in your innovative letter to attendings, utilized for residents considered high risk for falls, you asked about whether or not they would want to put alarms in place, which is usually a facility recommendation, and whether or not a restraint was warranted, which I thought was unique. And especially given the Code of Federal Regulations around restraints, detailed in Chapter 42, subsection 43.13A, how was this part of the letter received, especially when it came to the section entitled The Philosophy of Treatment?
Well, restraints in this environment were rare, but not non-existent. And again, what I sought to do with the communication tool is to get documentation of the physician's reasoning. Hmm. At the time this was originally authored, the alarms were not in the disrepute that they are now. And frankly, I think that the pendulum has swung too far, and that most of the time alarms do more harm than good, but not always. Hmm. Additionally, there are some alarms that no longer give a blaring sound that frightens the elder, but rather give a remote alarm at the nursing desk. And another version has the, let's say, daughter's voice pleasantly saying, "Mom, sit down. Mom, use your call bell."
Oh, I love that.
Not something that will frighten the elder. Mm. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The on the issue of philosophy of care, I added that specifically with a single case of a young man with Huntington's chorea in mind who was falling virtually on a daily basis. And our care plan eventually, after discussion with his family responsible party, was to allow falls and to minimize the risk of injury with falls with helmet and with elbow pads, with keeping clutter out of the room, etc. It was clear to me that there was needed to be a compromise between mobility, dignity, and quality of life in comparison to fall risk reduction. And in that case, where we had a young man and his bones were strong and he had life to live, clearly the equation went in the direction of allowing more fall risk and allowing more life.
Wow.
So we added that as a final item to the communication tool, and that should a physician check that there are interventions that would be possible but would be deemed more damaging to quality of life and dignity than he, she would want to order, then that would go to the competent patient or to the responsible party for validation. We anticipated that there might be some discord between those two parties from time to time, but over the 2 years, I didn't ever encounter that.
I just think it's so remarkable how you brought together mobility, dignity, and quality of life. And the only analogy that I can think of is that of dysphagia, in which someone says, "I don't want that pureed diet. I understand the risks. Do what you can to minimize those risks, but I want to eat a regular diet." That's kind of what it sounds like to me.
Absolutely true. But you know, applying this to the rank and file fall risk case, if we're overly severe with our fall interventions that then lead to a decrease in mobility and activity, and a total absence of risk, we guarantee that the resident will have disuse atrophy and go downhill.
Right. Which is why you started this by saying that it really is a nuance that each facility has to understand for itself and its patients and residents.
I agree.
Wow. So, Dr. Smith, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I wish to be just a little provocative with you. For you, what does nirvana look like in the case of fall risk reduction in nursing facilities? You actually, in the introduction of your article, you talk about the concept of the good fall. And while we can't eliminate falls or make any guarantees about falls not occurring, what will we be able to say is as good as we can get to satisfy surveyors, teams, families? How will we be able to play up the idea of this idea called the good fall?
Actually, I think I used the term successful fall. And a successful fall, in my mind, is one in which there is no injury. Falling is not the culprit. It's injury that matters. And so if an elder rolls out of a low bed and onto a bedside mat, that's a successful fall. If an elder is working with physical therapy on gait and grows too tired and their knees buckle and the therapist lowers them to a lower altitude or to the floor or floor mat, that's a successful fall. Those events qualify as falls under the survey definition and therefore have to go on your data, on your CASPER report, as falls. They don't represent bad care. And it's important when we look at CASPER data, quality assurance data, bad data doesn't automatically mean bad care, and many times it can be adjudicated by just drilling down on what actually happened.
Right.
The successful fall needs to be recognized by surveyors, and if we could purge it from the quality assurance data with a different definition, then we would be taking a step forward in having data that was more indicative of what's actually happening in the facility.
We have been fortunate to speak with and learn from Dr. David Smith about an innovative project involving a letter to the attending on reducing the risk of falls in nursing facilities. Dr. Smith, thank you for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
As we say in Texas, you all be careless.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.